Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Word down your way. Testing 2-2.
Well, welcome to another Word Down Your Way. Another musician about to go on tour and remembering first encounters with live entertainment. It's Charlene Spiteri. Charlene, lovely to see you again.
Nice to see you too.
And you're in your house very near London Zoo, is that right?
Very near London Zoo. Near enough that I can hear everything.
You can hear everything, right?
And I think you should tell people what you particularly hear during certain nights.
Well, it's kind of every night, but I got to say that the lions in Regent's Park and in London Zoo really love going at it, full swipe in the middle of the night, big sexual appetites. And it wasn't for, it was, I kept hearing this, I mean, that's what it sounds like. And you're like, what is that? And I asked in the zoo one day when I was in with my daughter, and I was like, what is that? And the guy and one of the zookeepers was like, oh, yeah, that's a lion's fucking. And I was like, oh, right, okay, lovely.
I hope your daughter wasn't 4 years old.
Is that actually the terminology they used?
Well, don't even start that, because, you know, that leads into a whole other conversation. I remember she was in the car with her dad, and she said to her dad, I think Michael Jackson was on the radio, and yeah, it was Michael Jackson on the radio, and it was at the point when he was married to Lisa Marie Presley, and her dad says, and you know Michael Jackson, and he's married to Lisa Marie Presley, and you know how much your mum loves Elvis, and da da da, and Misty must have been about, she would have been 6 years old or something, 6 or 7, and she said, do they have sex? And her dad nearly crashed the car. He was like, and he says, what do you know about sex? And she says, oh, Nora told me. Nora was one of her best friends at school, a little Danish kid. And I was like, of course, the Danish kid knows about
Danish kid. Oh, yes.
The Danish
well ahead of the game.
The Danish kid knew straight away. So basically, he says, what do you know about sex? And she went, yeah, I know that's what grown-ups do when children go to bed at night. So that was her. That was what Nora had told her, is that that's what grown-ups do when children go to bed, is they have sex. And then of course he's in this big explanation with her, and I was like, seriously, you told her it was like a special hug and friendship? I went, no, that's not what you tell her. When she's getting groomed,
it's what they do.
Yeah. So anyway, that was a long conversation. That basically, then I just said to people have sex to make babies, and she went, all right, okay, got it.
Okay. Perfect.
Is my tea ready?
Very good. Dave and I were just talking about the fact that you are, I think, the second former hairdresser that we've had on the pod in just a few weeks, because we had Susie Ronson, David Bowie's hairdresser, on before. And hairdresser, very much the same. The gift of the gab. Great talk.
And what do you call it? Kevin Rowland as well was a hairdresser.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah,
of course.
Kevin Rowland, the hairdresser.
Oh, yeah.
Not ambition, but what do you call it? Was known for his... there's loads of hairdressers. There's like quite a lot of people that were hairdressers.
Oh, really?
Became musicians. But I got to say that it does set you up pretty good for this kind of stuff.
Talking.
Because you weren't you in the Glaswegian salon when you were a teenager? You were, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. I worked at Irvin Rusk's on West Nile Street. I was a Saturday junior, first of all, and that was because I was at the Saturday classes at the Glasgow School of Art. So when the summer came round, I was like, oh God, I need to earn some money for, like, you know, inks and paints and stuff like this. So got a job, and it was kind of like, I saw this, they had a sculpture in the window, a Pagliacci in the window, and I knew the piece, and I was like, wow, that's really weird that they've got that in there in Glasgow. And I was like, that looks like a cool place to go. And I'll never forget, I went in and they had Cath and Hamnet boiler suits as their uniforms. And I was like, okay, this is the place to be.
Absolutely.
And started working in there. And funnily enough, it had such an influence on me musically as well, because we used to make up like mixtapes and everything for the salon. Like, you know, our bosses would always like, right, do tapes, and we'd all take turns of doing tapes that you play in the salon, and you know, music and the fashion.
So what would you put on? What sort of things?
Oh, you'd have everything. You'd have things like, you know, Dexys and Aztec Camera and, you know, Smokey Robinson, Madonna, you know. It would be all sorts of Fleetwood Mac. It would be like a real mix of stuff, and, you know, Echo and the Bunnymen, everything like that. It was at that point, Susie and the Banshees. It was all sorts.
Is it like being on stage, being a hairdresser, isn't it, really? Is it, you're on display, aren't you? You're expected to put on a little bit of a performance.
Theatrical show.
I never ever saw it that way. I kind of saw it more like being like... Because the thing is it's a very strange job, because... The reality is that you're seeing people with their hair wet, and then you physically touch them. You're running your fingers through the hair. That's a very sort of sensual thing to do, and it's a very personal thing to do with someone. So instantly when you go up, you kind of really just got to walk into it and be like, okay, you got to trust me here. And touching someone, and there's suddenly this thing that happens, and it's not about you and it's not about me. And it is the same way that on stage, you know, it's not the first second is sort of mine, and then it's like between the two of you, it's the exchange between, you know, between two people, whereas on stage it's the exchange between the band and the audience.
Right. So can you remember the first live performance you ever went to?
Yeah, I was a Saturday junior, I was underage, my big cousin Eddie Spiteri took me to see Simple Minds at Tiffany's. Yeah, I went to Tiffany's in Glasgow.
How old were you?
I would have been 15. I think it was about 15 years
old. What can you remember of that? Tiffany's were pretty small, presumably, wasn't it?
Yeah, Tiffany's was just, and it was right at the point of sort of Love Song and everything, which still to this day is my favourite Simple Minds song. I remember being, you know, number one, I was underage, so I was kind of like, whoa, this is different. It's people smoking and drinking, and it smelled a certain way. And this energy about it that I was like, this is cool. You know, when you start getting that kind of butterflies and you're thinking, I love this. Then the band came on, and the whole place just started like this movement that you've never experienced. And you're just like, whoa, this is just insane. It's like you're just pumping with this audience and it's moving. And, you know, I remember Jim Kerr coming on, and all the band, and Charlie, and he had on these kind of like knee-high boots, and he was doing this sort of like tiptoe dancing and, you know, moving in and out. And it was all like, and, you know, Jim was like dancing, doing all these strokes and movements, and he'd on this like silk blouse.
He did used to wear those early days, didn't he?
Yeah, and
I was like, it was really and sort of ballet tights.
Yeah, exactly. And I spoke to him about it, like, because I did this thing for them, a documentary not so long ago, and I was talking about it, and it was quite funny. Jim called me up afterwards to thank me for doing it, and he said, and I had told the story about this, seeing him in this blouse, and it was very feminine, and, you know, it wasn't what you saw guys in at that point. And he went, oh, it was Mama's. It was Mama's shirt, Mama's blouse. I borrowed it out of the wardrobe, and I thought, oh, this will look good on stage. And he was literally in his mother's blouse.
His mother's blouse.
Which is fantastic.
It is. Yeah. That's really good. Who else did you see around that time then?
Oh, there was lots of stuff. You know, there was so many of the bands that are coming through. Oh, my God. You know, I saw...
The Banshees, weren't you very...
I was a massive Banshees fan. The funny thing was, what was really difficult was certain bands would play certain places. Like the Clash did a tour, and the Clash played the Rock Garden, and I couldn't get in. I was too young. I just looked too young. And the Rock Garden was like a proper pub. So there were certain places that, you know, and it was like the Banshees and that, they played the Rock Garden, and there was just certain places that you just couldn't get into, which was hard. But everybody used to come through Glasgow. You know, I saw, who else did I see? I went to the Apollo. I saw Cameo. I saw Depeche Mode. I went to see Depeche.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. Who else did I see? I saw a lot. I mean, I've seen so many bands. But there was loads in those early days. It was like there was a lot of Glasgow bands. Like you would go to like clubs. I remember seeing I remember seeing Steve Strange. Yeah, I saw Steve Strange, and he did a PA thing in Henry Africa's. Saw that. Yeah, there was lots of stuff going on.
When was the first time you were on stage yourself? Can you remember that?
God. Yeah, I remember it like it was yesterday, because it's weird. You know, it's weird how things don't seem that far away, and then suddenly somebody's looked at you. Yeah, that was like 37 years ago, and you're like, it was Dundee University, and it was the bar in Dundee University, and I'm not kidding you. The bar must have been about 10 inches, 12 inches high, and I was still shorter than most of the audience. I remember we played, I'll never forget that we played I Don't Want a Lover twice in the set because we never had enough songs. I was hanging on to my guitar for Grim Death. It was kind of like the safety, you know.
I was going
to
say, yes.
That barrier between me and the audience. And I just remember, like, I'm not kidding, I'm surprised I never left a hand mark on the neck. It was literally, I was squeezing it that hard. And,
is that still the case? I'm really interested in this because I've always thought that people behind guitars, and I think this particularly applies to blokes, feel less vulnerable than people standing on their own
completely.
With the microphone singing. Tell us about that.
I mean, I do both.
Yeah.
Because I play guitar most of the time, but a lot of songs I don't play, there's a few of the songs I don't play guitar in. And it's weird because I had shoulder surgery just before Christmas. And for me, the really strange thing was that they said, well, because I went to Australia and New Zealand just in January, end of January. And they said, you're probably not going to be playing guitar. And I'm not kidding, you see the panic. Not because, but it's like, I know the songs with guitar. I know the way they are with guitar. It's like, Jesus, can I remember the actual words if I'm not playing
them?
No, yeah, no, it's all muscle memory.
Really weird thing. It's like, how do I sing it? And doing this piano record at the moment, suddenly doing it in a very different way, whereas I'm not playing guitar, I'm just singing with piano. It's sometimes I kind of go, there's like bits of me that just physically start moving in a really, like, because I'm used to like doing something at that point. So that physically, it's strange for me. As far as like, it definitely at the beginning, for many years at the beginning, Texas gave me that, I guess it gave me like I think it also gave me like a toughness and it gave me a seriousness of, I'm a musician, I can play an instrument as well as a woman, which sounds really, I mean, I say it and I think, how stupid is that?
No, not at all.
You see, I always think it's really interesting about guitars, particularly electric guitars. They're kind of heavy machinery, aren't they? You know what I mean? Oh,
hence why I've had shoulder surgery.
There you go.
Yeah.
You know, it is. It's like, you move different, you act different, you sling on a guitar and you're literally like, come on, bring it on.
Yeah, absolutely.
You put a guitar on and you just kind of think, yeah.
You so and were you watching army. Particular, I mean, in terms of role models? It wasn't just solo singers. Were you tending to watch the kind of Chrissie Hynde type people who you know, were...
Chrissie, I love it. For me, it was all about Joe Strummer. I mean, I know Chrissie played a Telecaster as well, but for me, it was like Joe Strummer was my god.
The black Telecaster.
Black and white Telecaster, yeah.
That's right.
And basically, I remember, you know, at the beginning, I remember early days seeing... this footage of Joe Strummer of the Clash, and you know, just as a band, they just looked so complete as a band. Like, just you were like, that's who I want to be. And I remember Joe Strummer was spitting out the words, literally, like spitting them out, and he ripped his sort of the side of his hand on the pickup, and he was bleeding onto the scratch plate. And I remember thinking, yeah, I'll have that. That's where I want to be. That's what I want to do. That's my idea of. It was just so passionate and real and. You know, just, but really weird because it was so emotional as well, and in a really weird way, gentle, but literally in your face, which I remember thinking, yeah, that's my band, and that's, I want to be Joe Strummer.
Brilliant. And you, your second gig, weren't you kind of chucked right in the deep end and you finished up in some huge support slot?
Yeah, we ended up opening up for Fleetwood Mac, second gig.
How did you get that then, if you were so unknown?
Do you remember back in the day when you used to get the phone call on Tuesday that you just got Top of the Pops?
Yes, yes.
The band used to get that call, and basically what it was the band that were opening up for Fleetwood Mac, they'd just come from Ireland, they were coming to Scotland to do Edinburgh, and they got Top of the Pops. So, yeah, they went to do Top of the Pops, and our promoter was like, listen, Fleetwood Mac need a band. You're doing it. That's it.
And what was the venue? Was it huge?
Edinburgh Playhouse.
Right. Okay.
And I had never been on I'd never stood on a theatre stage in my life. You know, it's like a big, really? And it's an old theatre. So the stage is, I can't do it with my arm. The stage is angled, so it dips forward.
Raked, yeah. Like,
yes.
You know that thing where you stand on a stage and you kind of go, "What is this?"
Because it's
be on a ship.
That's yeah. Right. Holy shit. And I remember, you know, all Fleetwood Mac's gear was there when we went to do the sound check, and giant writing on Christy McVie's piano, it said Edinburgh. And I remember thinking, who the fuck doesn't know where they are? jump 2 years later, being on stage, and like,
you're doing the same thing.
Exactly. Like, somebody written where I'm on my set list. Like, you know, literally having a nervous breakdown because I don't know where the fuck I am. But yeah, that was it. And I remember, you know, Mick Fleetwood and John McVie watching the gig, and you know, and I was a massive Fleetwood Mac fan. You know, Dreams was one of the first songs I ever learned to play on guitar, actually. Two chords, you know, easy peasy. I remember thinking, do you know that thing when you like first learn to play guitar and you can sing a song and you can play a guitar? And your mates are really impressed. Literally, like, hell, sure, I can play and sing. And Jesus, that's like a song. And I just thought I was
there's A minor and F and G.
Yeah. The two going back and forth, that's it. You know, it's a great song. Great song.
So do you, just going back to that point, do you still have written on your set list where you are? You've got to have that, have you?
Yeah, now you're kidding. I can't even remember my name on stage half the time these days. I saw this amazing documentary about Dusty Springfield. I think it was Lulu was talking about Dusty, and she said, do you remember when she used to do that thing where she'd go, lick her hand, she went, I just don't know. Like, apparently she had licked the lyrics because she could never remember lyrics.
Really?
Apparently they were written up her arm, and that's what all the... she was like, and apparently she was quite blind, so she was like going like this, and she could see the lyrics up her arm.
Pre auto cue and
I mean, I don't have an auto cue. I'm not that. Yeah. I mean, I'm still.
No, I'm talking about her. Right. That's amazing.
I still write like key words on my hands and my arm just because I'll be like, you know. Sometimes I like put little things across the top of my guitar, so is it my acoustic, whatever. So I can like, oh yeah, I remember that now. But once you get going, you know, once the tour starts rolling and suddenly, you know, you've done like all the rehearsals and stuff. But sometimes there's certain things I just am like. Hit a blank. Totally hit a blank.
So what do you do if you... I'm amazed that people can remember so many lyrics. I mean, obviously you would have written them and stuff, so they're fairly familiar. But, I mean, what do you do if you do forget? I mean, do you just improvise?
I normally start laughing, and I normally turn to Eddie Campbell, our keyboard player. I'll literally go, Eddie! Because Eddie's the one that always remembers everything. And then, but he's got to the point sometimes where he goes...
Oh.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
So this tour that you're embarking on soon, what can people expect?
It is the best of, so it's the best of tours, and you're going to get all the big hits, and hopefully, you know, you're going to get from 1989 right through to present day.
Right.
And what have you learned about being on stage? What things over the years? What's the valuable info you can pass on?
I don't know if I can pass on any valuable info. I mean, I'm terrible. I fall about stages. I come off black and blue. I jump around. Then I do stupid stuff that I realise I can't get back up on the stage. I'll jump off it. I'll do it. You know, I love it. So invaluable would probably be think before you do something stupid and work out a route back. Yeah, because I've had security lift me back on the stages and everything because I'm like, I thought, I can't make it back. I need to get down into the audience. Yeah, I absolutely love the whole being on stage live thing. I love that. Going back to like my first gig, it's that moment of complete euphoria and shit, and you know that whole thing, it's like stoking a fire. You're sitting suddenly like, come on, right, let's go, we're going to go. Are you taking it right down? Like just those moments of like, okay, right, I need a minute, so we're just going to bring it right back. You know, I remember I actually learned a lot from John Mellencamp. The truth is we years ago went on an American tour with John Mellencamp. And John Mellencamp taught me so much about being on stage and about stage presence, which was really strange.
What kind of things? Give us some details. That's interesting.
So before I went to tour with John Mellencamp, I mean, I knew Jack and Diane. It was like, you know, her little story. I didn't really know that much about John Mellencamp. And, you know, our record company was a bit like, you'll never see him, you'll never meet him. He hasn't had a support band in 10 years, you know, whatever, just get on with, do your job and come home. And we played the first gig, and after we came off stage, knock on the door, John Mellencamp walks in and he's like, hey guys, how you doing? And we were a bit like, thought we were never going to meet you. And he's sort of like laughing. I mean, his hatred for record companies is hysterical, I guess. And I was like, oh, great, I'm not the only one. So, yeah, he's like, oh, they don't even know what they're talking about. They're just assholes. I just always see them. But I always see everybody else. And he said, you know, are you going to watch the show? And we said, yeah. And he says, come up on the side of the stage. Went up on the side of the stage watching the show. And halfway through the set, he sort of shuffles over. He does this little shuffle thing, like a soul thing. Like, he comes over and he's like this. He says, do you know Pink Houses? And I was like, yeah. And I'm thinking, you know, it was the days before mobile phones where you couldn't just Google lyrics. So I'm like going, oh God, I know that ain't that America bit. And I thought, wing it, you know, because that's the hairdressing days, is like, I'm just going to wing this. I'm just going to go with it. And he pulled me on stage, and I did. He pulled me on every night, and he would say, you know, Texas opening up for me. And he was just really kind and really gave us everything as a band that we wanted. Didn't pull down the volume, you know, because some bands do all that stuff. He was like, my stage is your stage. What you want, if any you need to use, use it. You know, he was just really kind and really giving. And he used to sound check. And when he used to sound check, he used to go out into the sheds. He'd go out into where the audience is at, and he would watch his band and he would sing back so he could get this idea and so he could see what they're looking at. And I was like, oh, okay. And he used to tell me, talk to me, and he was the one as well that really taught me how to stand back from an audience and just wait and like literally go, you know, you get a big set of balls, you'll be able to do it. So just move back and like wait for them, just wait for it to start. You'll feel it start to go. And, you know, and that's at the point where you're letting you guide, you know, like guide them and through the show and like, okay, I need you to come with me. So at that point when you start moving and you're, you know, that's at the point where they're going, all right, we're going with you. So there was a lot of that, and I just learned so much off him.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant.
You're playing a Cheltenham racecourse, we noted. So that's it. What are those gigs like? Was that after the, you know, presumably after the races, it's the day of the races, and the band comes on, and you know.
I mean, seriously, it's hysterical because you get people in that. I never knew what a fascinator was until I did.
Yes.
And Jesus Christ, now I know why they're called fascinators.
Yeah.
You really want to take that stupid shit off your head, you know. And it's really funny because by the time they get to the band, they're all a bit.
Yeah, I can say.
Yeah, yeah.
Full on. I mean, it's like a proper night out in Glasgow. It's literally, they're like.
It's a wedding, isn't it?
And there's a lot of that. It's, you know, there's. And the best laugh is when it's raining, is if it's a wet one, they're like drought rats. They're literally standing there. You know, this
broken
like,
high heels,
dangling fascinators.
Drooping fascinators.
Feathers like this, like across your face. Yeah. And they're like, you know, very, very, very worse for wear. Most of them, they're a good laugh. It's an experience. The first time you do it, you know what it's like when, you know, when you walk on stage and especially when you do something the first time, because you have that thing of like, what do you mean? You have that. Why would you be in a hat at a gig? So, you know, that stupid thing you have as a musician where you're like, you know, you get a bit snobbish about it and then you just, fuck it, let's go. And off you go. And it turns into being like, quite entertaining on our side as well. It's fun. It's a lot of fun.
I bet. So you're also working on your own thing as well as Texas. Is that right?
Oh no.
Oh right. Okay.
But sorry, you've done a record with Spooner Oldham. Is that right? Yeah.
The Spooner thing. Well, yeah, I did the Spooner thing. We went over to Alabama to Muscle Shoals at the Fame Studios, and we made this piano record with Spooner. So basically, Kenny Gates, who owns PS Records, he has this, we call it his baby.
Spooner, who is how old now? And 80 now?
He's old now. He's
wow. 80.
Yeah. I mean, he's fantastic. He's one of the kindest human beings I've ever met. You know, he's so humble. You know, you really try and, I mean, the records that Spooner's played on, I mean, just saying the first four Aretha Franklin records is enough. Apart from, you know, he played When a Man Loves a Woman when he was 14 years old.
Yes.
I mean, that's insane. And then he tells you stupid stuff, like you're talking to him because you really have to press him to get stuff out of him. And then he starts talking and he gets really emotional and he's just like, oh my God, you just want to hug him. And he's just amazing. He tells you all these amazing stories when he was making these records and when he was writing with Dan Penn and stuff. And then he'll suddenly be like, oh, yeah, when I played on that Liberace record. And you're like, you played on Liberace records? It's like bizarre stuff that he comes away with. So, yeah, he's just an amazing human being.
Right.
He's still touring. He still plays with Neil Young now. He still goes out with Neil Young.
Yes. Brilliant. Do you think you'll still be doing it when you're at Spooner Oldham's age?
Hope not.
Why not, though? Willie Nelson's 90.
Willie Nelson's 90. He's shaming you all.
Bob Dylan's his.
I don't think I will ever not sing. That's the truth. And I don't think I'll ever not play. But, you know, I think I'm really lucky. I'm really lucky that the way, because of the way our music is and because of the way I am as a person, I can adapt to, you know, because you do adapt. You, there's certain things you won't do that you did when you were like 20, like, because then you look like a dick. Yeah, I always think, you know, and especially like, you know, I ain't going to be lucky if I don't need to go on stage and give it all that shit. So, you know, I can just go put my guitar on, play. I can do things like stand with a piano and do this piano record and sing the songs, because I'm very lucky that the way the songs are and my voice, that that's what I use. That's what my thing is. It's like, that's it. It's not bells and whistles, and I don't need the bells and whistles to do what I do. And sometimes stripping it right back, for which is what we've done with this piano record, is like when you take it down to its rawest form of how the songs are written, it's weird because with this record, you know, I was like, I'm not going to do any promo or anything. We said to the record, oh, you know, we're just going to put this record out because it was a project that we did. And it's all the Texas hits just on the piano. But, you know, people have gone a bit mad for it. And, you know, especially in France, and literally, like, I've been here three times in the last 3 weeks, literally doing, and people are like, oh my God, you know, you're like a soul singer. And I'm like, do you know that thing when I'm a bit.
The piano.
Yeah. And do you know that thing when I'm kind of going, like, I mean, going like, well, that's what I always thought it was anyway, but never mind. Whatever, yeah. It's only taken you like 35 years to realise it. But then again, what you think you are and what everybody else thinks you are two different things. And yeah, so it's, I guess when the songs are stripped right back to the rawest form, they hear something very, very different in it. And that was what we were hoping to do with this. And, you know, just the opportunity to play with someone like Spooner was an absolute thrill. So yeah, it was great. I mean, you know, it was just him and I. Sorry, my dog's going. Him and I, like, going, sitting on a piano stool with me tapping out the timing on Spooner's thigh. So yeah, it was good.
That's brilliant.
Very good. Very.
So
good.
So we just end with the greatest show. It's probably going to be Joe Strummer, but the greatest show you think you've ever seen. What would that have? Would that
probably
be?
Prince.
Right.
Yeah, Prince in Paris at the Bercy. That was unbelievable on the Sign of the Times tour, which was like off the chart. Like, you know, when just the show started with the band coming out through the audience and they all had the snare drums. Like, it was just like, you'd never seen anything like that. But also,
I saw that tour. It's stunning to the theatre.
It was absolutely stunning. And
the
just
props, you know. And it was in the round that I saw. I think you saw
exactly. Yeah. It was in the round, and it was like
it would appear from under the stage.
You know that thing, you're just like going, and you remember the band all comes down from all the different sites. It was just, it was so unbelievably thought out. It was just amazingly executed. And Prince is insane, because I mean, another one that I saw was Prince. I mean, I'll always go on Prince. I saw Prince at Café de Paris, one of those ones where it was the after the show.
Yeah.
And everybody was waiting for, oh my God, it was hours and hours and hours and just waiting for Prince to come. And then he came and it was like, oh my God, like the dancing, and you were so close to it. That was what was amazing about it. And everybody was just hanging off the balconies at Café de Paris, just watching. It was heaving and everybody was there. And it was just on, you know, and the songs went on for like 15 minutes and things, and he just did whatever he wanted to do. And it was just amazing. The musicianship was insane. Sorry, my dog's going to jump up in the seat now. Get up there.
Right. No, it's unbelievable what he was capable of doing, wasn't it? The writing and the musicianship, playing all the instruments, the production, the dancing, you know, the theatre.
I mean, after that Café de Paris one, it was like just Misha Paris had just kind of like started, and Prince was obsessed with Misha Paris at this point. And I remember going up the stairs and coming in, Misha was there, and she was like, hey, and she's like, oh, child, this is Prince and everything. And I remember meeting Prince and being like, I mean, I'm not kidding. I remember he turned around at one point and his bum kind of fitted in my hand. It was that small. I'm not exactly big, but I remember thinking, oh my God, he's ditchy. And it was just like, you know, but he was gigantic. You know, he was just such a presence, and everything, you know, seeing that, what he gave, because it was just like, it was raw. It was just like, you know, it was so well rehearsed. It was so, you know, I remember I told this story like recently on something, and I remember my best friend's son was trying to get into to Berklee music in Boston, and he had to do his audition, and my friend says, because he didn't get in the first time and he went for the second one to try and get in a second time, and he ended up getting in, but my friend says to him, you know, can you give him some pointers and stuff? And I said, well, how tough do you want me to be? And she went, go full on. I went, okay. So I said to him, get your pieces ready and then I'll come. So I go to the house, he phones me up and says, I'm ready. I turn up at the house and I go up to his bedroom and he starts messing about with his amp and everything, and he's like fiddling and fussing, and he's like, oh, of course, you know, when I do it, it will not sound like this on the day and whatever. And I just got up and walked out of his room, just left, went down for it, said to my mate, make my cup of tea, and she's like, what's happening? I went, you'll see. And then he comes back downstairs and he's like, you know, what is it, what is it? And I went, well, do you think if something goes wrong on the day that you're going to be like turning? And, you know, I don't care that you've known me since you were born, but, you know, when you see me on stage, does it look easy? And he goes, yeah, it looks relaxed. What I says, it looks easy because it's so rehearsed. Musically, yeah. Musically, you could literally turn the lights out, switch everything off, kill the electricity, and I'll just keep going. That's how well I know it. I says, because that's when you have that freedom of knowing your instrument, knowing what you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but play with the songs, go in and out them. That is when then you can do a show. That's when you can like talk to the audience, stop what you want, come in, blah, blah. You know, there's all that freedom that comes with that unbelievable amount of practice. Yeah. And I remember saying that to me. That was what you saw with Prince, was like Prince could literally just go, I like go crazy on stage and give every little ounce of energy that he had, because he would just keep going, because that's how well he knew what he was doing. And it's really, really, really important. You know, it's not like people kind of go, oh, it's this, it's that. It's not a game. You don't get to be still doing this after this amount of time just because you kind of like it. You know, it's like you got to, I love what I do, but I work.
No, well, that's really obvious.
I work really, really hard at doing what I do.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic. And the tour is, well, I mean, our advice to anybody watching is get your fascinators out and head to Cheltenham. But the tour starts off in what, in the autumn, I think, doesn't it?
Yeah, the tour's in September. We're playing the O2 in London. We're playing Hydro in Glasgow. We're in Cardiff. We're in Manchester. We're all over. We're like, so it's an arena tour.
Right.
So come and see us on that in September, because that's the very best of. That's what people are going to see on that.
Brilliant. Well, it's so nice to talk to you. Fantastic.
Word down your way. Testing 2-2.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right, because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1, only from Rust-Oleum.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.